were not allowed to go to school, and nor could her family pay for it. But she was very smart, very curious about things. And it seemed there was a real spark about her in spite of her circumstances. When she was 10 years old, her family sent her off to, as kind of an indentured servant, you might say, in a way. Luckily, the other family were very nice, and Toy Lin took care of their young children and was in turn nurtured by that family. She, because her own family really couldn't support a girl, another girl. There were many in her family. When it was time for her to be married, her mother chose a husband for her who had been in the United States working. Probably he had worked on the railroad, something like that, or before that, many, many Chinese men in particular came and helped with the gold rush, the 1849 gold rush. And they would do the work that really women traditionally would do. They cooked, they did laundry, they dug ditches, they did all the menial kinds of jobs. And when her future husband, Mr. Moy, came back to South China, they were married. She hadn't really met him before. They were married, and then 4 months later, he went back to the US to work, and she stayed behind. He sent money back, so she and his mother survived okay. But apparently he died. I think he also died of tuberculosis. There was really a lot of that. And so her mother was very concerned, because at that time, what do you do with a very young widow? It was a problem. You need to marry her off again, because the mother had very little income. It was just in general considered a big problem. Finally, the mother found the name of a man in another village who was willing to marry her. He also was in the United States. He had essentially sneaked into the United States because of the Chinese Exclusion Act. He was not allowed to enter into the US. After the gold rush, after the Chinese immigrants helped with building the Transcontinental Railroad, there was really something of a slump in the economy. And suddenly, as has seemed to have happened so often, the Chinese were blamed. There was lots of violence against Chinese people, and it was really a terrible time. But Toy Lin's next husband, whose name was Dogon Goon, had managed to sneak into the US and had worked in laundries and cooking in Chinatowns on the Eastern Seaboard, so in New York and Boston. He'd made his way to Portland, Maine, of all places, and worked in a laundry there, which actually Toy Lin went on to work at too, very long and very successfully. But Dogon had quite a story attached to him. When he was running the laundry in Portland, one of the immigration agents in Boston was on the lookout for him and arrested him and sent him to prison. He was tried and was going to be deported. Luckily, Dogon was clever and had good friends. One of the friends testified that, oh no, no, Dogon is an American citizen. He was born in the United States. He was born in San Francisco. I remember him as a little boy. I remember his parents. I remember the street they lived on. Well, the immigration agent was furious because essentially he knew that wasn't true. But there wasn't anything he could do about it. The reason was the great fire in San Francisco, all of the birth records of the Chinese community was at City Hall, and they were all destroyed. So a friend's saying that he was a US citizen, there really was nothing that the immigration agent could do. The judge said to Dogon, well, are you willing to fight? It was the time of World War I. He said, are you willing to fight for your country? And he said, sure. So he was granted, or his citizenship was upheld, which he'd never really had. And because of that, he was able to, after the war, go back to China and bring a wife, a Chinese wife, back with him, which under the Chinese Exclusion Act, he would not have been allowed to do, because any Chinese immigrants were not allowed to bring family to the US. They weren't allowed to vote. They had very few, if any, rights at all. So meanwhile, Toy Lin is working on her dowry back in China. She's sewing beautiful, beautiful outfits. She's taking care of her mother-in-law's remaining children. And she was a tireless worker, and she kept waiting for her husband. The two of them were married by proxy. He was in Maine and she was in China. And a rooster on a chair sat in for the husband. So there was this amazing this amazing ceremony. They were wed, and yet she'd never seen him. Finally, many years later, some years later, he was able to go back to China and meet her, and they came to the US on a steamship called the Empress of China. They arrived and took the train across Canada down into Boston, where she went into the Boston immigration station and was held in a jail for enough time for her to prove that she was the wife of an American citizen, which was tricky because many people were turned away. This immigration place in Boston was the equivalent of Ellis Island. So the conditions were very harsh. But finally, Toy Lin prevailed. She and her new husband motored up to Maine, which, I mean, it's just amazing to think of that time. And suddenly she was learning how to speak English. She was working in a laundry, which she had never done, and having children, one after the other. Finally, after two, within less than 2 years, she said, Dogon, we gotta hold off. I want 2 years at least between the children. So they eventually had a total of eight. And it was quite a time. For those of you who know Portland, they lived on Forest Avenue, and the building where their hand laundry was located is still there, although it's not a hand laundry anymore. It's at essentially Woodford's Corner, which some of you may know. Toy Lin worked, they say she worked about 16 hours a day. And then her husband died. He had a injury from the war and died, leaving her with these eight children. She hung on, and she was quite a brilliant manager, I would say. I can't even picture what she was able to do, but she had a system. And I want to read you just a tiny bit about her system. The kids were going to school and doing very, very well in school. That was Soylent. Okay, here we go. Running a laundry was a hot and physically taxing business, especially at first when most of the jobs were done by hand. Toy Lin and her husband, when he was alive, worked side by side. They owned an electric washing machine, but the crank of its mangle was manually operated. At night, clothes hung from the ceiling on wires above the pot-bellied stove. A door sealed off that area, so the little drying room heated up. In the morning, clothes were ironed, folded, wrapped in brown paper, tied with twine, and sorted for pickup. As soon as they were able, the children helped out. The youngest checked pockets for cigarettes or coins. The next oldest sorted sheets and pillowcases or separated men's cotton shirts from their celluloid collars. After school, the more grown-up ones ran back and forth from the stove to a long table, carrying hot 8-pound irons for their parents and oldest siblings to use. The family didn't take vacations. The children wore hand-me-downs and they shared everything. Even at the age of 93, Carol, the oldest son, said that whenever he sees a candy bar, a rare childhood treat, he still pictures it divided in 8 pieces. So, and after Dogon died, Toy Lin trained the children to work, which they did every day. But then she had a plan to keep the laundry open. She convinced her oldest son, to stay back from high school. He was going to be a junior in high school. And she said, I want you to work with me for 2 years so your younger brother can go to high school and finish. When he finishes, you will go. And then the next youngest will stay back and work with me at the laundry. So it was a really a beautiful system that worked very well. And the kids did great with this, apparently. All 8 of Toy Lin's children went on to higher education. The oldest son graduated from Syracuse, Johns Hopkins Medical School, and on and on. They were Bowdoin, MIT. It was pretty extraordinary, the accomplishments of that family. And it seemed to be a pretty happy crew, from what I can tell. I met one of the daughters named Doris Wong, who ran her own business in Boston. She had a court reporting business and hired many people. She invited me to come down and have lunch with her in Boston one day when I told her I was researching her mother. And she appeared, she was about half my height, was wearing a nylon leopard skin print skirt and gold flats, and she was a real firecracker. She was quite wonderful, devoted to her mother, who had, of course, died. But all of the kids were very brilliant and accomplished, and a lot of fun, from what I can gather. The Toy Lin's claim to fame, she probably would have gone not been particularly remarked on outside of her family, as is the case with so many people who had amazing accomplishments throughout their lives, but don't make it into the newspapers necessarily. She had one white woman friend who taught English. Clara Soule was her name. And she convinced Toy Lin that to be nominated as Mother of the Year in Maine. Toy Lin was not literate in Chinese or in English, and her spoken English was a little flimsy, but she said, okay, if that's what you want, we'll do that. So Toy Lin was nominated for Mother of the Year in Maine, and she got it. She was granted Mother of the Year. There was much fanfare in Portland anyway. And because she had won in Maine, she went on to the national competition. And by God, she won that too, which is just really, talk about remarkable. But there's a piece of history here that kind of fits into Toy Lin Goon's becoming National Mother of the Year. This was during the Korean War, which was a time not only of obvious physical warfare, but of propaganda. And the Chinese really liked to advertise how terrible America had been to Chinese immigrants. And they brought up the Chinese Exclusion Act and the persecution of Chinese in America. To counteract that, here was Toy Lin Goon, American Mother of the Year. So it was very good PR. Although it was more than that. Toy Lin was a very inspirational woman. She was very, I wouldn't say shy, because she was confident in herself and in what she had accomplished, but she was not vainglorious, let's put it that way. But here she was, this small statured woman being given a ticker tape parade in Boston Chinatown, in New York Chinatown. And there's a wonderful picture of her standing up in a convertible, waving kind of like Queen Elizabeth, you know, like this, as if she were born to the realm. And people just going crazy about this. She was on movie tone newsreels, which I remember seeing as a girl, at least newsreels. So her face was splashed all over the movies all around the country. And she was invited to Congress. She had lunch, I think it was, with Bess Truman. and it was just quite the wingding. She had arranged for someone to take care of the laundry while she was doing this. One of the things her children loved best about this was they were invited to Valley's Restaurant, which was in Woodford's Corner. Those of you who know Maine of a certain age would remember Valley's. And the family had never been to a restaurant. So the Doris, my friend, kept laughing about which knife and fork to use. They of course used chopsticks at home. So this was all a great novelty for them. Finally, the children convinced their mother to sell the laundry, and she moved down to the North Shore of Boston, where she took care of her children's children and was very good at giving advice, apparently. Do this, do that. How much money are you making? She seemed to really want to know what people's incomes were and couldn't they do better? And she was very much loved and almost worshiped by her children. Several of them went back to China, invited her. She said, no, I don't want to go. But they built a school for both boys and girls in the father's village, which was very meaningful to her, she who had no formal education at all. So that's the story of Toy Lin Goon. Yeah. Does anyone have any questions about other? Oh, there's Donna.
And Donna, yes. Can speak.
I have a question. Do any of the family still live in Maine?
You know, they don't. But there was actually an exhibition of some belongings of Toy Lin that were part of an exhibit of the Chinese in Maine historically. And she had these incredible silk robes, I guess, dresses that she had made herself out of something called mud silk, which is a kind of silk that was washed in river, in rivers, and got silt into it, which apparently gave the silk a very beautiful kind of a brown sheen. And she had those. They were packed away in a trunk, which she never had opened. She wore house dresses once she came to the US. She had a sewing machine. She learned how to sew. So she wore the 50s house dresses, as some of our mothers did, grandmothers maybe. So what was your question?
Oh, if any of them lived in Maine. Oh, that's okay. This is great. Keep going. I was curious.
Somebody's phone. Yeah, she, but there's a number of them in Boston, Donna, living around there. And also, gosh, the eldest son who was became a doctor, he practiced medicine in rural Utah for his whole, I think, Bluff, Utah town for all of his life. It's just kind of interesting.
That's amazing. But, thank you.
Yeah. Yeah. Any hands?
Yeah, go ahead.
Somebody? Oh.
No hands up.
No hands up. Okay. Well, I'm not doing my job then. You should have lots of, you should have lots of questions. Let me tell you a little bit, time is running out, but tell you a little bit about a woman that I particularly loved, who was a Penobscot Indian, a basket maker. And she was born in 1884 on Indian Island in the Kennebec River on the little tiny island. The mighty Penobscot, who had their land was the whole Kennebec watershed, and they had traveled that seasonally. They would be in the winter, they would be in the woods hunting, and in the summer they would travel down to the coast. There were some who came to Chibig, I think, if I'm not mistaken, maybe not Penobscot, maybe Passamaquoddy or Mi'kmaq. But anyway, Florence's family were kind of hot tickets in the Penobscot community. They were very well known, very well educated, well spoken. And her father, Mr. Nicolar, was a representative to the state legislature in Augusta. So she was raised to go to school, learn a lot, and be upwardly mobile. When she married, she and her husband lived on Indian Island, but it was very hard to make a living. It was terrible, in fact. Many people didn't want to hire Native peoples, and they were really quite mistreated in that, certainly in Maine at that time, frequently. Florence and her husband moved down to Connecticut and worked for a while. And then when the Depression hit, they moved back to Indian Island, where they stayed for a while. Something that was really interesting about Florence was that she was very quiet. She played beautiful piano. She was quite cultured, not only in Penobscot civilization, but also in American civilization. And she came at a time when the best thing you could do for your children was to have them grow up speaking English, so that her eight children went to school, spoke English. But Florence, from the very beginning, was aware of the prejudice against her people, and she and her sisters tried to do something about it. The first thing they did was protest about the mission, Catholic mission school on Indian Island, which they believed gave them a very subpar education. They wrote to the legislature, they visited, they petitioned, and finally, what they wanted was for the kids to be able to go to the old town schools, to the regular school system. Finally, they succeeded. The legislature changed the law so that they could go to Old Town, which is the nearest town to Indian Island. But the Catholic Church threw them out. They were expelled from the church. Eventually, they started their own church, not a Catholic church, but they were movers and shakers. If they saw something that was wrong, they tried to fix it. Florence and her two sisters were powerhouses. Her sister Lucy was very outgoing. She was an entertainer. Her third husband, who was something like 20 years younger, they were had a vaudeville act, and they would wear really Plains Indian headgear, which is not at all their background, but they would make a living and tell stories, and somehow or other they maintained their own culture and seemed extremely aware of what they were doing. So in other words, using the white culture to make a living. The second thing that Florence did was she was really upset about transportation. The way it was at the time she was a child and all through her young adult years, you got to Indian Island via a 14-person rowboat. You paid 2 cents and you were ferried out. Now, the problem with that was bad weather. In the winter, they would spread sawdust on the ice and walk across. But in the time of ice out in March, April, there were all kinds of accidents. It was very dangerous and people died. Also, children couldn't go to school. They were marooned in bad weather. So it was just another indication of a second-class citizen. Finally, I think it was 1950, a bridge was built and dedicated, and it's pretty exciting to go over it onto Indian Island. It's a short distance, and just to think about what this group of women in particular was able to do. The last thing that they did had to do with suffrage. Chester Arthur had passed, was it Chester Arthur? No, I have that wrong. Take that back. At the time in Maine, there was a law stating that Native peoples could not vote. They were classified with criminals, morons, and some other category of apparently subhuman people. So this very, very upsetting, of course, to people on Indian Island. When Florence and her husband lived in Connecticut in the 1920s, they had voted in the election of 1928, in the presidential election. And it kind of didn't occur to them that when they got back to Maine, they wouldn't be able to. The other thing was it bothered Florence that during World War II, her four sons were drafted. They went to war. One of her sons was a combat medic who landed at Omaha Beach. He crossed the Rhine and had a very difficult time. In 1945, though, he came back on furlough. He stayed in the army. He came back to Maine on furlough, and he and his family went across the bridge, I guess, and were marched to the Office of Voter Registration in Old Town. And they were told no. And here was here was, oh, what's her husband's name? I mean, her son's name. Charles Norman Shea. Here he was with in his uniform covered with medals, marching at the head of this amazing family. And they were told by an agent of the city, of the town, of Old Town, no, you, we don't want people like you voting, you can't. So anyway, eventually, Florence and her sisters and many other people petitioned. Florence wrote a book of pamphlets. She wrote to Franklin Roosevelt. Finally, in 1953, the family was and all of the Native people of Maine were able to vote. So it was a huge, huge victory and so shocking. 1953 was just yesterday, wasn't it? In a sense. But that's the story of Florence Nicolar Shea. Any questions now? My friends?
Donna, go ahead.
Go, Donna. Love you.
When you were talking about Indian Island, people from Indian Island did come to Chibig. And they also, okay. Passamaquoddies came to Chibig too. But if you, when you're at Indian Island, if you go to the health center, it's the Ruth Addy and Davis Health Center, and it's named after Ruth Addy, and who spent her childhood summers on Chibig Island.
Oh my gosh, Donna.
To become a public health nurse.
Wow. Isn't that great? Wow. Gee.
So if anybody goes up there, you know, that's a Chibig connection.
Always a Chibig connection somehow or other. Well, it's been a great pleasure for me to talk to you and talk at you, I think, more than with you. And I apologize for any snafus, but to see your shining faces, the Chibig faces, and my sister in Asheville, North Carolina, and sister-in-law in California, it's really quite wonderful. So thank you so much. And wait a minute, Beverly, hi. Here's Beverly Johnson, Jill Whitman, wow, Mary. So thank you very, very much.
It's great to see you, Katie.
yeah, thank you. It's great to see you, yeah.
It was wonderful, Kate. Thank you so much.
It was just a great presentation.
Maybe next
my
week,
pleasure.
Come back and you can tell us about more of these people.
Yeah.
Okay, great. Got it. And let's have it be live.
Yes.
Well, yes.
I would like to thank everybody for tuning in tonight. And I apologize for the technical difficulties. It was kind of strange. It just all of a sudden went away. But we certainly did get a lot of good information and as a lot of fun. And please do, one way or another, come to our annual meeting coming up in July. July.
June.
Did I say? Yeah, June. I'm sorry.
That's okay.
Thank you so much, David and Donna.
Yeah.
Well, thank you. And I'll end the meeting at this point. Thanks, everyone. Good night.
Bye-bye.
Bye.